From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump's supporters for weeks heard their leader claim the election was stolen from him. They heard his exhortations to head to Washington, D.C. to stop the steal. They listened, they breached the Capitol, rampaged through the halls of power, and some, it seems, intended to take hostages or even murder lawmakers. Now they're planning armed protests at all 50 state capitals on Inauguration Day. Clearly, many Americans were caught off guard by the January 6th attack. Will the coming violence catch us off guard as well? My guest is Imara Jones, the founder and creator of Translash, a cross-platform journalism and storytelling project, which centers the stories and humanity of transgender people of color. She's also a Soros Equality Fellow and just published her analysis of the Capitol attack entitled, "We've Entered the Most Dangerous Period of the Trump Era." Welcome to the program, Imara.
Thank you for having me.
So there's this one sort of narrative that has emerged from January 6th, which is that these protesters, which is what they're being called, or patriots, gathered there to peacefully send a message to Congress that they don't want, that they think that the election was stolen, and that at one point they sort of spontaneously ended up being able to enter the Capitol and mayhem ensued. And of course, the right-wing media has its own take on that narrative, which is that it was actually the people who entered were actually Antifa infiltrating the Trump people and, you know, were hell-bent on ruining their reputation. That's a narrative that has emerged that has some, is getting some traction in some media outlets. Why do you think that that is, that it's dangerous to think that that's what happened?
Well, because it's not what we know happened, and it's what we saw with our own eyes did not happen. We know that from everything that is being reported in so many areas, that there was a subsection, it seemed, of those who entered the building who were organized and who were focused, who kind of were at the front of the mob, and once they entered into the building, knew where to go and what they were trying to do. So this is the type of thing that happens in developing countries all the time, where people who are attempting to overthrow a government use a protest as a way to seize power by transforming the demonstration into an insurrection. And that's what was attempted last week. And we know that with our own eyes. We know that almost everything that you framed as is out there in the dark corners of the internet, less so in the mainstream media, I have to say, I've been really fascinated by the transformation on places like CNN, who are beginning to call this what it is. They had an entire program called Trump's Insurrection. But the narrative that is in some dark places of the internet is just not true, and we know that.
So these, you know, there is a section, and of course, all Trump supporters aren't the same. Many are just simply individuals who watch a lot of Fox News and who've become radicalized online. Some are very organized, right? You've got the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and these very organized, essentially, you can't call them anything other than militias. And they were mixed into the group and part of the group and perhaps are the most dangerous aspect of this group, right?
Yeah, I mean, anyone who has military training, you know, many people who are in the Oath Keepers and in the Proud Boys and in the 3% movement and in the Boogaloo, less so in the Boogaloo, but in the ones that I just named, have former military backgrounds and have backgrounds in law enforcement. And so I think that anytime we have people who understand how to use military weapons and tactics, many of them who fought in insurgent wars and know the tactics of insurgencies and how to transform, like I said, a demonstration into an insurrection, we should be concerned. And of course they are dangerous, and they've been dangerous for a while. There have been reports, even at the highest levels of government, saying that domestic terrorism is our greatest threat. And, you know, there's a real question as to why we are just now keying in into the threat.
Why do you think that this particular effort was one that was not taken seriously by the Capitol Police? I know you have experience having worked in Washington, D.C. The Capitol building has its own police force. And now, of course, there's going to be investigations that the police chief who's resigning said that he was turned down when he asked for help. But of course, we know last year when Black Lives Matter was in Washington, D.C., and whenever we've had sort of left-wing protests at the White House, you have a pretty militarized response if the movement is big enough. Why do you think they didn't take this threat seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's so many questions about that, but I think that they didn't take it seriously because if you look at the Capitol Police chief reports to the two sergeant at arms, essentially the people who are the top security people in the Congress, there's one for the House and one for the Senate. We know that the sergeant at arms, both the sergeant at arms in the Senate and the deputy have a background in working for, having been hired for, and by mostly Republicans. And so it takes both of them to agree for the Capitol Police Chief to be able to take action. And what is being reported in the Washington Post today is that the Sergeant-at-Arms for the Senate was blocking the actions that were requested by the Capitol Hill Police Chief. And the question is why? And did any type of political framework come into that? In terms of that decision-making, I think that we need to know that. That's one question. And then I also think that there's a really big question as to where was the quick reaction force? We know that there are quick reaction forces of the military that are not that far away from the Capitol that should have been mobilized. And if there was an international terrorist attack, would have been mobilized and been there in very quick time. And so why both in terms of what happened on the front end and during the siege, why didn't those things happen? And why was it that the Washington police are the ones that actually regained control of the Capitol? There are a lot of questions.
You write in the piece that you published on your website, imarajones.com, that you think that this was a test run for Inauguration Week. Indeed, leading up to January 6th, had people enough of the people in power and our mainstream media pundits being paid enough attention, that January 6th attack, I think, might not have come as a surprise. So what are the warning signs about Inauguration Day?
Well, I think that the warning signs are incredible. They are flashing red. The technical term for what happened and if it was indeed a test run, which I believe all the signs point to that it was, is a forced demonstration, right? They came to show what they could do and then to see what they could do and how to do it. And I think that everything that we know in terms of reporting in the last 48 hours here is that there are possible demonstrations across the country at each of the capitals in the 50 states on Saturday. One of the reasons why we now know Parler was taken down and why the social media companies, private companies across the board were so quick to take down their websites is because they believe that action is being organized in the Capitol for January 17th, which would make sense because it's the day before Martin Luther King. And that means that a lot of the people that they would need to mobilize across the country would have off from their jobs. We know that many of the people that showed up had all types of jobs, from legislators to accountants to lawyers.
Police officers.
Police officers, former military, a former lieutenant colonel, in the Air Force was one of the people who helped to take the floor of the Senate. And we know that there is also chatter about the 20th. So I think that the board is flashing red in terms of what is possible and what is being planned on top of what was happening. And I think that there is a much more serious focus on all of this now, as it should be, because the board is flashing red. Another thing that I think that we should pay attention to was, one of the ways we can see that it was organized is that the Capitol wasn't really taken back, it was actually surrendered. So when sufficient force showed up on the Capitol grounds, everyone holding that building just kind of melted back. And that shows you that there's an organization, there's an understanding of how force works. There was an attempt to, again, see what could happen. And then once there was the possibility of the people who were organizing it in real time being bagged, they melted away. Many of them melted away. And so, you know, there are all these indications, I think, that this threat is very, very, very serious. It's focused, it's organized, it's purposeful, and it's being timed to try to prevent the next president of the United States from taking office.
I'm wondering what you think about the fact that there were some officers, Capitol Police officers, who were quite badly brutalized. We're seeing now a video of one among many who were trying to hold back a sea of people and who was almost crushed in a doorway. Another horrific incident of an officer being dragged out onto the steps, beaten with a flagpole. You know, these were the ones that were trying to do their job, presumably. Then, of course, we know that there were some officers who casually let in some of the folks through the barricades, took selfies. And then, of course, there was the experience of the Black officers who experienced very overt racist hate speech. One officer, Eugene Goodman, actually emerging as a hero for having directed the protesters, the so-called protesters, we should really call them rioters, away from senators who were there. So I'm wondering if you have any reflections on Capitol Police, the various ways in which they might have been both perpetrators, but also victims and targets.
We don't know, and it needs to be looked into. And I say that because the facts have to be established. We know that there were some police officers that seemed to be friendly towards the crowd, and others who lost their lives. And I think that's one thing that we need to find out. One of the fascinating things as well about the situation in the Capitol Police is, why were there so few that day? I mean, only a small fraction of the force was mobilized. Only 25% of the force was mobilized that day. So even in terms of their own force posture, just the Capitol Police itself, they had 25% of the resources deployed that day, which also needs to be looked into. And so, you know, I think that there are lots of questions, and it shows something about leadership. That is to say that when you have individual police officers making decisions about what they're going to do, that signals that there's an absence of leadership, that there's no one who is saying, you know, don't let anyone in, or, you know, here's the line that we are all backing up to and protecting, or let them in even, right? It means that in the absence of leadership, you have individuals making their own decisions, which is why we have such a range of activity in the Capitol Police that day. And that's because it doesn't seem, from what we are seeing, that there was anyone who was giving clear orders that day about what would happen, what was happening, what should happen, and what their orders were. And so it leaves individual officers to make up their own minds about what they're going to do.
I want to link the attack on the Capitol to what people of color have been experiencing over the past 4 years in particular. There was such fear when Trump was first, you know, when he first came to power. There were, you know, lone voices saying, this is a white supremacist man. And of course, there were some in the media who were loath to call him a racist overtly. But people of color have been basically the targets, not just of Trump, but of Trump's base. We saw in Los Angeles on the same day that the Capitol was attacked by this pro-Trump, almost entirely white mob. We saw a microcosm of that mob on the streets of downtown Los Angeles attack a black woman, almost lynch her. And, you know, Congress may have been attacked in the Capitol, but the real target, isn't the real target communities of color in the United States and their political power, the space we take up?
I think the real power, I'm sorry, I think the real targets as they would see it is actually a power structure which doesn't overtly benefit them or work towards what they see as their need. You know, we know that when people entered the Capitol, one of the things that they kept saying was, this place is ours, this is ours. I can, I can defecate in these halls, which we know that they did, and then smeared it over the fresco.
Smeared their feces on the walls of the Capitol.
Is, you know, as a marker, right, to show that we can literally do whatever they want. And I think that the fear of the incoming government is that it won't be to their service. And you can fill in the blank of who the they is in their framework. That is to say, right, it's people of color, it's women, it's LGBTQ people, it's immigrants. Like, there are a lot of theys, and a lot of them gravitate towards different things, right? So it really depends on the group. It's like, it's an alphabet soup of kind of extremist groups. But what they fear is whatever that is. And so for some people, that is Black people. For some people, it is people coming across the border, all the rest of it. And so I think that that's what they fear. It is a giant they. It's not only specifically communities of color and the power that we are wielding. That is a part of it. But there's also gender and also sexuality and also immigrant status and also disabilities, right? Really scornful of a nation that is sensitive to people who have disabilities. So it's all of that. And I think that that's the thing that we should be focused on and not get segmented, because their movement, ironically, right, and the way that they look at the changes in the United States, they actually have an intersectional framework in the negative. That is to say, they fear anything that is a threat to who they believe are the legitimate inheritors of the American project, and that is overwhelmingly white men. And if it's not white men, then it's definitely this legacy of white supremacy.
So equality with the other, quote unquote, is seen as oppression by them.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. And the other is giant. I mean, in their mind, right? And that's why they're reacting with such fear, because they fear the equality with all these different types of people, and it is nerve-wracking for them. They see it as a mortal threat.
The response from Congress so far has been long on rhetoric, short on action, although it hasn't, of course, even been a week. So I suppose we can give them some time to react. But do you worry that they won't react strongly enough? Because in the past, we've seen both Democrats and certainly Republicans have given Trump far too many passes on things that he should have been impeached. You know, he should have been impeached 100 times over. But if they don't respond to an attack on their house and on literally their lives, they've basically capitulated and rolled over, right? Like, how important is the moral significance of a swift response to what happened on January 6th?
Yeah, first of all, I think that that's happening. I think the fact that articles of impeachment have already been drafted, that there is scheduled to be a vote in the House of Representatives on a Wednesday, that is light speed for Congress. Nothing moves that fast. I think it reminds me of the resolution of the Declaration of War against Japan and Germany. That moved that fast. Moved lightning fast. So I don't think that there is a failure here, of acting quickly. I think that they are moving with incredible speed, because there is a recognition of the incredible danger that they face. I also don't think that there is a both sides ism on this. There are lots of areas and issues where we can say neither Democrats or Republicans have been strong enough. No, this is not that. Democrats have actually done their job and have done their job on this to protect the Constitution, both in November and now.
And they've used the terms insurrection, sedition, attempted coup, all of which are the right terms to use for this.
That's right. But I mean, even in November, right, the entire Democratic caucus voted to impeach him with one Republican, I think. And all the Democrats voted in the House to convict him. So there is a clear party divide here. No, this lies at the feet of one party, and we need to have moral clarity about that. Regardless of what you think about the parties in general and where they are, there is a clear choice on this. And there is moral clarity between the two sides about where they stand. The lack of progress, if the Republicans had done had voted to convict him, in November, we wouldn't be in this situation. We are here because people like Susan Collins said that she thought that the impeachment showed Donald Trump the error of his ways, you know, because people, you know, and that therefore she didn't need to vote for conviction because impeachment showed him the error of his ways, right? We know that even earlier this week, that as a first step, one of the things that the Democrats did in the House of Representatives, in addition to proposing, introducing rather, the articles of impeachment, they introduced a resolution saying, Mike Pence, it is our sense that you need to invoke the 25th Amendment now because it's actually faster than impeachment. And they wanted to vote on that. The Republicans blocked them. So this is not both sides, and this is one particular party which sees in its interest the need to feed and coddle and protect and align with extremists whose goal it is to overturn the government, even though themselves they were at risk. You know, even what happened on the House floor when they were barricaded in there and there were guns drawn at the door, one of the Democrats shouted to one of the Republicans on the other side, the name is escaping me right now, this is because of you. So I think that we need to be very clear here that there are lots of times where we can say it's both parties, and we can go down the list. Immigration, there are a lot of issues. But on this, there's not. This is clear. And there's one party that's behind this.
Well, let me finally then ask you, Imara, in terms of how these groups have been organizing, of course, they've done it through social media. They've done it through Twitter and Facebook, and then they migrated to Parler. Trump has been kicked off of most, if not all, I believe, of the major platforms. Parler no longer has a web hosting home. So it might be difficult for them to organize than it was before, but some on the left have said we have to be very careful of the overreaction to what happened on January 6th because we cannot use that as a way to undermine civil liberties, free speech, et cetera, et cetera. How do you respond to that?
We always have to be careful about that. We don't want to create a solution that is bigger than the problem that we face and therefore creates a bigger problem. Right. And so we need to be wary of that. And we, in recent memory and in the recent past, have lived through that. So we need to be concerned about that. But I also say that there are progressive people on the left who have been calling for Donald Trump to be banned from the public sphere for years now. One of them that springs to mind is Rashad Robinson. You know, Rashad Robinson wanted The Apprentice canceled. And imagine if that had happened, that the entire platform for the Trump presidency would have gone away and we wouldn't be in this position where there's a possible armed coup against the United States that is being plotted for next week.
Right.
You know, and on this particular point, if you cannot be banned for armed insurrection against the democratically elected government of the United States, what can you be banned for? That means there are no limits. Right? That means that there are no limits. And there are limits to the First Amendment. This idea that there are no limits to the First Amendment, there are. There is over 200 years of case law, which says that there are certain things that you cannot say. And so there are already limits on the things that people are complaining that there are limits on, right? And all these companies are private companies. They do not have to follow even the legal fields of law on the First Amendment. And so I think that we're at the point here where people need to understand that the threat is real and that it is giant. It is not a small threat. This is not a free speech argument. You know, if this was only about free speech, who would care? If it was two sides arguing on the public sphere and saying things, that's fine. But people are using these platforms to plot the downfall of the United States so that they can install a fascist government and commit genocide. There were people, you know, in the Capitol wearing shirts that were saying, that said 6 million were not enough.
Camp Auschwitz was also seen on one man's shirt.
Yes, for the Holocaust. So I think I understand, and as a journalist, as a person who creates content in the media, and as a person who's experienced discrimination by these platforms, look, you know, Facebook throttles trans content all the time. We fight those platforms all the time. But even I, who have experienced that with these platforms, believe that this is entirely different and that the threat is real and that we need to understand that this isn't about the First Amendment, that this is about violence. It's about inciting mass violence, and it's about their desire to create chaos through these platforms so that they can target all of us who are not a part of a white supremacist vision for America. And so if you can't be banned for that, I don't know what you can be banned for.
Imara, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your insight and your time. We'll post a link to your website where people can read your work. Thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thank you so much. Same to you.
My guest has been Imara Jones, founder and creator of Translash, a cross-platform journalism and storytelling project which centers the stories of transgender people of color. And she's also a Soros Equality Fellow. Her article published on imarajones.com is entitled, "We've Entered the Most Dangerous Period of the Trump Era." We'll post a link to it from our website. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.